I declare the winner of the 2019 Brownlow Medal, Nathan Clark of the Fremantle Football Club.
She from the mountain needs to be in perfect the years. He's got the most impossible goal. From inside the centre square, Boyd kicked the goal.
Welcome back to another episode of the Centre Square Podcast on Sport FM 91.3, your football headquarters. Great to have you company from wherever you are tuning in from. I'm your host, Bray Loveridge, and I'm joined by Ethan Roth, Noah Tonkin, and Luke Evening. Boys, how are we travelling?
Afternoon, Bray. Very well, thank you. Yeah, we don't often do this, the four of us, but looking forward to another big episode once again.
Yeah, no, it's good to have all the boys back together. And, you know, we're excited because footy's coming back soon, so yeah, hopefully not too long.
Yeah, good to be back. A bit squeezed, don't have much room on the table because we've got three sitting here and then Bray with all the room up the other end, but no, it's good to be back.
Once you get the control, the power to look after all the volume and the computer, you get to sit here, Noah. I know you did well on the phone call episode with Andrew Cracker, so up and coming. Ethan, what do you got for us?
Yeah, we'll start with the injuries and who's batting the clock for round two. The ones we haven't really touched on in previous episodes, so most of these are soft tissue injuries. So Adam Treloar, calf, Collingwood reckon 1 to 2 weeks. The same with Ben Reid, his teammate, another calf, 1 to 2 weeks. We'll move on to the Bombers. Dyson Heppel, he has a foot injury, 1 to 2 weeks again. Orazio Fantasia, just recently, a quad, 2 weeks, which isn't good. Lively small forward for the Dons. Magic Door, he has a pectoral muscle, 3 to 4 weeks. Not good, is it? We want him back after that initial bridge incident. Robbie Gray, he has a broken toe, which will hope power confident he'll be back into the Crow, so just 1 week. Basha Hawley has a calf, 2 weeks at least. And then Joel Hamling, big news out of the Freo Footy Club. Most likely season ending with an ankle. He will require surgery.
Yeah, no, Freo not doing too well with the back six at the moment. Alex Pearce was out last year and, Joel Hamling out again, so not good for Fremantle's back six.
Yeah, he's a key part of their team. Flies a bit underrated, but he sort of controls the back six there and, obviously experiences the premiership player with the Western Bulldogs. So,
yeah.
As a Freo supporter, I'm not too happy about that. But that's mainly all the injuries. We'll move on to the big three six representatives. June 8th, these players will go down the slide. So far confirmed, Toby Green from GWS, Bailey Smith, Western Bulldogs, Ben Brown, North Melbourne, Patrick Cripps from Carlton, Orazio Fantasia. I'm not sure if that quad will affect him going down the slide.
Extra
recovery in the ice bath.
This will be an interesting one. Mitch Robinson. He's a
big fan base.
Yeah, volunteered himself. Brandon Ellis from the Gold Coast, Jack Rewalt from the Richmond Footy Club. Christian Petrarca was the first, to put his hand up, or Melbourne was the first to put in their player. Still side bottom for the Pies, Isaac Heaney for the Swans, Taylor Walker for the Crows, Brad Shepherd from Bray's West Coast Eagles, Brad Hill from St Kilda, Tom Rockcliffe from Port Adelaide, Joel Selwood from Geelong, Isaac Smith from the Hawks, and just came in today from the mighty Freo Dockers, Sonny Walters.
Sun.
Yeah.
He's been in the news a bit lately. He's not only going down the slide, but they reckon he could be the first Indigenous coach to coach an AFL side.
Yeah, Ross Lyon stated that. I have been to the Dockers training, and he does talk a lot of yelling to his other players. So, yeah,
he seems like he has a good footy brain. He knows like what he's doing, and obviously he's one of the more experienced guys at the club. The AFL Hall of Fame started on Monday night. John Kennedy Sr., 3-time Hawthorn Premiership coach, known for the famous "Don't Think, Do" speech in grand final. I think it was 1975. And Lenny Hayes, he also got inducted. 297 game at St Kilda great, 4-time All Australian. But I hate to admit it, but I'm a bit surprised that he got in. What do you boys reckon?
Well, just a quick one. Has Boomer Harvey got the Hall of Fame yet?
No. I'm just surprised with Lenny Hayes because, yes, he's a great player, and I'm not saying he's not, and don't get me wrong, he's one of like the modern-day champions.
Yeah.
But when you've got guys like Voss, Buckley, Hurd, who haven't been put in yet. I know they'll have, there's still time, and they'll probably get overtime. Same with Gary Ablett. I just, maybe, I'm just a bit surprised. That's just me with Lenny Hayes being inducted.
He only played 297 games.
Only?
Yeah, well, there's a lot more that's played more that aren't in the Hall of Fame.
I don't think it was on games.
It's
I
not
think
on games.
Yeah, no, but
it's
still.
Not, it's not the most.
Boomer Harvey, he isn't in there yet, is he? Mm-hmm. And he's played 430,
I don't know if he ever
whatever
there,
it was.
Yeah, but I think if Lenny Hayes got one or two premierships, that would up him a bit, but still, I don't know.
I think he's one of the most liked players in the comp. Like, everyone loves Lenny, there's that saying, and I think that might have had a little bit to do with it. Not to take anything away, he was a great player. I think it might be some preference.
Yeah, well, he did have a great game, that 2010 draw, earning the Norm Smith. I remember he kicked a goal from outside 50. Pretty sure at the time they said it's his first ever goal kicks outside 50, and like, what a time to do it as well. So, yeah, definitely not doubting his playing style.
And of course, the second night of the Hall of Fame, two Brisbane players got inducted, which was Simon Black and Jonathan Brown.
Yeah,
two three-time premiership players, obviously out from Brisbane.
Yeah, and Simon Black, you know, everyone all over Instagram was all over his thing with Blackout Tuesday. That was obviously for Simon Black. So, yeah, big fan favourite.
I'm not sure about that one, but...
We want Brownout Tuesday next Tuesday, so, yeah.
We'll see what happens. Maybe you're right. But, yeah, I reckon those two are definitely deserving of it. Both three-time premiership players. Simon Black won a Norm Smith and a Brownlow. He's a very humble guy. He's from WA, actually. Not too many people know that. He was drafted
from Brisbane, wasn't it? Yeah.
But, yeah, I think...
Yeah, I didn't even know that.
Because he's been there for a while. I think he's kind of... You know, when players go over and they're sort of seen as in that state just because they've been there. And I think he does live there as well.
Yeah,
I'm
pretty sure he does.
Got family.
Sport report on 10 years.
He was on the
Brisbane
Survivor. And last night on the Hall of Fame... Sarah Jones hosted it, but they were saying, they asked him, people know you mostly because Survivor? And he was like, yeah, that's probably why. Like, not too many people would actually think, oh, he's a footy player.
Who's this? Well,
Simon Black.
You know,
definitely not.
A lot of people who watch Survivor aren't just from a footy background. They're anyone watching. They could be rugby, they could be soccer, they could be...
Well,
not
the most
even the
recent
ball sport
thing you've done was Survivor.
Yeah.
So maybe
that's
why.
It's
say
just fresh in people's memory.
I guess younger people who, like ourselves, who weren't really like watching football when they were dominating in the early 2000s,
wouldn't
really know him properly.
Mm.
And then if we watched Survivor, we'd know him a lot more. So I guess that could be a factor, I guess.
Otherwise, very well known. In separate news, though, players going into the hubs are wanting to take or have things such as toasted sandwich makers, PlayStations or Xboxes, and NutriBullets to make it feel a bit more normal when at home. And they've also found a whole golf course within the Royal Pines. Caroline Wilson spoke about this on Footy Classified, but that's good. So we can kind of put the golf debate to bed because, you know.
Last night on Channel 7, Justin Longmuir and Basil Zemplis spoke about this as well with the PlayStation, sandwich makers, and all that. And Justin said that they probably should be able to because they want them to make it feel like they're at home.
Yeah, and
make them feel normal. They don't want to feel like it's a footy trip or they're in prison. They want to make them feel normal.
Yeah. Some of these players have routines which they stick to as well. And it's what's that saying? Were they? They're superstitious where if they don't follow that certain routine, then it's like they might not even play well on game day. So they're trying to normalise it as much as possible.
And, like Tendai Mazungu, he had a Subway before games, I remember him saying.
Yeah.
And they're probably not going to be able to do anything, like go out
and
get Subway
and
anything.
Andy Brayshaw was actually on AFL Tonight last night with Kath Lochnan, and he was saying they're trying to get cars, a certain amount of vehicles so that players might be able to get groceries from the stores. But it was interesting. Andy Brayshaw, he was very, like, he seems very keen and happy to get over to the Gold Coast. Like, he obviously he doesn't have kids or, like,
a wife.
It'd
be a good experience, really.
And a young person who, I'm assuming he probably likes to surf. You'd probably know that.
Brayshaw?
Yeah.
No.
Not a surfer?
No.
Hayden Young is, I know that.
Yeah, he'll be wanting to go over to Hayden Young.
Yeah, but, obviously he doesn't have any kids or family, like the experienced guy, so he's not.
Yeah,
and he said it'll be a good opportunity for a team bonding as they're still a young group. Yeah.
And those young guys, it'll be like a big holiday for them. They'll be stoked to go to the Gold Coast for 4 weeks.
Yeah, holiday footy.
Exactly, and playing footy. So they'll be stoked for that. But the older players, they're probably the ones that won't be happy because they've got families and they've probably been on those long holidays before. Yeah.
And that brings us to our next topic, Will Schofield. He's still weighing up if he'll fly over with the squad. He has business interests, and including media, and of course with the wine company, with last week's guest, Chris Marston. So they're pretty similar in terms of not fully loving their footy. They have other outside interests. So I think he won't be at the club next year from what I've heard. He'll either retire or they'll just say, look, you won't be here next year, which I don't think he'll be too fussed with anyway.
Yeah, well, Will Schofield's the only one we've heard that is contemplating not going over, but I reckon in these next 2 weeks there'll be a few more which come out and say either they're not going or they're close to not going.
But he can be a pretty handy player because if someone, a key defender, goes out with injury, you know Will Schofield is the type that you can just say, we need you to come in and play a role.
Or just step up if he's already playing. Mm. So I thought he had a magnificent grand final in 2018 and has done a lot of good things for the club in the past. So he's definitely one of the club's best at the moment.
He's a true
clubman,
isn't
he? In terms of experience and the quality of a player himself.
Just a team man. And finally, former Hawthorn and current Carlton high-performance coach Andrew Russell has copped a fair bit of criticism. I know Kane Corns was on his tail a bit, for telling another player, Buddy Franklin, to lose weight, which is a rookie error, really. And to make it worse, he said he was going to call him to chat, which Carlton obviously wouldn't be too impressed by. I mean, that's not really on another player from another club. I know you're going to have contacts, but, yeah, you probably shouldn't be saying that. And, it was funny, though. Just lastly, Kane Corn said was angry about it, but that he was talking to Justin Longmire from Sydney, and he was talking to him about Joe Danaher, and Josh Longmire's like, oh, no, you can't just bag someone from talking about another player and then talk to us about Joe Danaher when he's from Essendon. So, Kane Corns, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, well, that's Kane.
It is.
A lot of controversy.
Controversial Kane Corns.
Mm. He's full of it.
Terry Max living.
Yep, all right, well, we're going to wrap up the first part here after the break. We introduce our special guest, Subiaco Premiership player and Sandover medalist, coming up right after this.
Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to the Centre Square podcast on 91.3 Sport FM. The guests don't stop, and today we have one of the modern-day greats in the WAFL who is building a very nice CV over here in the West. 2019 Sandover medalist. He's a four-time Subiaco Premiership player. He's currently played 104 games for the Lions since crossing over from Victoria for the start of 2014. It's versatile ruckman Lachlan Delahunty. Della, welcome to the show, mate. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, boys. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, really appreciate your time. We'll jump straight into it. So you grew up in Victoria, as just mentioned. Tell us about your life was like in the eastern states, coming through the ranks of Frankston. There's been a few draftees come out of there, so it must be a great club.
Yeah, so originally I'm from country Victoria, so I grew up on a farm in the northwest part of Victoria there, so Matella was my home club as a junior. So I spent all my time there until I went to boarding school, Ballarat, and progressed in the TAC Cup, so similar to the Colt system over here. I played for North Ballarat Rebels, and then from there spent some time at Essendon. Never made their list officially, they wouldn't take me on, but I trained with them for 2 or 3 years, when James Earn came on actually, and then couldn't really crack a game in their team regularly, so I went to a standalone club in Frankston. So I don't know if you know Melbourne too well, but Essendon to Frankston's probably an hour and a half to 2 hours apart in peak hour traffic, so it was a change up for me. But I was at university at Deakin there and went to Frankston for 2 years and had a ball, really. We didn't win too many games, but we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, so can you talk us about the transition to Perth and what sort of attracted you to Subiaco over the rival clubs over here? And did you know much about the club's history before you signed?
I had absolutely no idea, to be honest. Very much, when you're in Victoria, you only really care about Victorian footy, and if that was VFL or AFL, I didn't have much an idea of Sandful or the proud history that the Waffle had, so I didn't actually know who Subiaco was, or West Perth, or East Fremantle, or any of the teams. But I'd been contacted by West Perth the 2-3 years when I was at Frankston. They would come over and meet with me once a year and said, look, we'd love to get you over at the end of the 2013 season, I think it was, and just show you a bit about Perth, a bit about the club. And so I and Matt Boland, who come over with me to Subiaco, we both come over together, and Subiaco were pretty keen to get Matt Boland, and West Perth were pretty keen to get me. I don't think Subiaco were all that interested in my ability at the time. I don't think they were chasing a... At that stage, I was playing on the wing. They were looking for a full forward and centre forward, and I probably didn't meet the brief. But met with a few clubs, West Perth being one of those, Subiaco being another, East Fremantle being another, Perth. We actually met with four or five clubs, and to be honest, it was meeting the players, coaches, and going through Subiaco and getting an understanding of that rich history they had. Keeping in mind that 2013 season, West Perth actually won the premiership, and Subiaco finished second last, so it wasn't like I was coming over here to play in a premiership. I just met the players, and you know, Jared Schofield was the head of that operation. I could see they were trying to do the right things and heading in the right direction. But they had a really good culture where, you know, you could tell that they were a good bunch of people to play footy with, and that was more important to me than the success that, you know, may or may not have come about. And I was just very fortunate to form part of somewhat of a dynasty.
Yeah, so you've lived here for a few years now. If you had to pick one, where would you rather live? What are the pros and cons of both states? Obviously, the weather's a bit better over here, but do you still consider Victoria your true home?
Yeah, I think the quality of life in Perth is much better than that of Melbourne. I go back quite frequently with my job, and you know, once a month I'm back in Melbourne, and it's just the hustle and bustle. It's amazing how quickly a day can go, where Perth, you know, the people tend to be better to work with and better people in general. I better not hope there's not too many Victorians listening to this, and you know, doing business and or playing footy over here. I just think the quality of life, the weather, it's a big country town in some senses, makes it far more attractive for that. So you know, I definitely prefer the quality of life here in Perth in comparison to Victoria. Obviously my family and everything's still in Victoria and in Melbourne, etc. So I think Victoria will always be my home, and I go back and you know, go back to the farm quite regularly, so it's that will always be considered home. But certainly if I could talk family into backing up moving to Perth, I would absolutely talk them into that.
Yeah, so we'll get to your first few seasons at the club. The club came off for a poor 2013 season, finishing second last, and then obviously 2014 went to finish second on the ladder, beating East Perth, who you were underdogs to, as you lost to them a couple weeks prior. So how did things turn around?
Yeah, it was interesting. So we rocked up, obviously, like you said, we were coming second last the year before. I think that year, not that I should talk about gambling and all, but we're paying $80 to win the premiership that year, which is quite amazing. So that was probably my initial insight. Not knowing anything about football, I thought, well, I probably haven't come to the right team if we're paying 80-1 to win the premiership. But it's amazing how quickly that can turn around. I think that was built on, obviously, Jared Schofield and what he was trying to create. They were probably unfortunate the year before with injuries, and it probably wasn't a true reflection of how they performed. But then he was looking for certain players to fill certain positions, and I think you know, the inclusion of Wade Toomey, Matt Boland into that side, obviously I think I added some depth into that, and there was two or three others that you know, obviously increased the depth of an already relatively strong team that was probably underperforming. And those group of players sort of gelled together really well, both on and off the field. There's some really good friendships, and Scully's, and I don't know if anyone has had much to do with him as a coach, but he's very driven and ran a really good program that we all bought into, and I think that team camaraderie and all buying into a game plan, probably better team that was full of better individuals on the day. There's no doubt East Perth had a stack full of West Coast players, and they beat us by 60 points probably the week before in the dry weather. But sometimes, you know, old saying, a team of individuals won't beat individuals playing as a team. So I think that was a huge part of that philosophy in 2014. We really gelled together and probably blessed with significant downpour of rain played into our hands. You know, certainly if that had been a dry game, it might have been a different story, but it was a perfect storm and we managed to get an amazing win that day.
Absolutely, a bit of a blessing in disguise. The next season comes around, and as you look to go back-to-back, the club continues to recruit well, adding the likes of Sam Manigola. You're a lot more of a dominant force, which set things up for the years to come, but what are your memories from that year, and what was a pretty unforgettable one for WA footy as a whole?
Yeah, that team, Shane Yaron was playing then as well. He's probably outside of Cole Horsley, he's the greatest player I've ever played with. Add Sammy Menegola to that. Like, you look at that team, and we had so many great individuals, but so many great individuals that played well as a team. So I think 2014 was probably one more lucky to win, but we'll take it. 2015, I certainly felt we're absolutely the best team that year, and I think we're going to take a lot to beat. We, you know, that was our second year together as that group, and adding Sammy to that, and obviously, you know, I think Shane Yaron was in full flight that year, kicking, you know, bags of goals. So it was, yeah, an incredible season, and one that I was definitely more confident going into in that final series than I was in the previous year.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, winning the two grand finals, they were both pretty different games. One was a close game and the other was a blowout. Did one feel a bit sweeter than the other? And who were the best boys that celebrated in the evening?
Yeah, certainly. No, so I think, well, 14 was definitely a better game, but for me, I just rocked up in Perth, and really I probably didn't get a feel for it until January, February. So even as the year went on, it was still so new and foreign. I didn't really understand WA footy, so I think I probably enjoyed 15 more because I felt more a part of the culture, I felt more part of the program, and I felt comfortable in the maroon and gold, where, you know, the year before it just all happened so quickly. So I think I appreciated 15 probably more than 14, but when you look at the games and what it probably meant to the club, I think 14 probably might have held more weight. Some of the better performers off the field over those years, Matt Boland's pretty hard to beat. He's only here for 2 years, but he certainly left a bit of a legacy and one that was hard to keep up with. Outside of that, you could probably throw a blanket over some of the others. Chris Phelan was always a strong performer. Kyle Horsley, you know, probably those who were better on the field certainly performed off the field. A bit of the mentality there at Subi at the time, so they were all enjoyed the wins as much as anyone.
Yeah. Now, something that many would say is my one with a lot of discussion around it is the Freo and Peel alignment. What do you think of the alignment? And obviously, it pretty much cost you two flags in 2016 and 2017. How unfair was it?
Yeah.
And are you happy that there's no alignment this year?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting one, and we can, you know, debate about it, or people have their opinions. For mine, it's, you know, it's a part of the Waffle program now, so it's just another hurdle that we need to take into account. So I don't hold any remorse that was the case. They obviously changed the rules after that, which that in itself is somewhat disappointing in the sense that you feel that, you know, once they change the rules, it's like, well, you know, we're two premierships potentially taken away from us when those rules weren't in place. But they're the rules put in place, right? And this year we're on the other side of that, where they've reduced our ability to recruit any players. So it comes with anything. Once something appears to be unfair, that the Waffle will adapt and change, and they probably made the right call in all situations. So, you know, it's not, I don't disagree with the alignment. I think it's an important part. I think it adds a different element to the Waffle competition when you've got two AFL teams. I think it's great. And for us, it's, we just have to get better and make sure that we're well conditioned to be able to compete with the AFL talent. And we did that last year. We did that, you know, the year before. And we love those challenges. Really, really enjoy playing against those list of players to prove that we've got players in our teams that, you know, are certainly better than some of those list of players.
Yeah, so another year on into 2018, how did you react and find out that Jared Schofield wouldn't be at the club for 2019? And how much did the club want to send him off, as well as his son Taj?
Oh, no, yeah, no, sorry. On 2018, when, yeah, that season, coming into that season, I suppose we weren't aware that might have been the case. We're on a bit of a mission then, like Scully as well. He was, you know, we took it to probably another level. After losing those two, there was a lot of hurt and a big point to prove, I think. You know, there's nothing worse than having that feeling that you potentially lost two premierships that may or may not have won if circumstances are different. So the whole team was on a mission to succeed. Never did we think we'd probably go through, you know, a whole season undefeated, but it doesn't surprise me looking back on how determined everyone was to achieve that year.
How much did the all three grades within the club really, like, unite the club?
Yeah, it's something that's never been done, right? So it was huge. It was, you know, it's one thing to have a strong league team, but have that success and strength throughout your reserves and your Colts, you're right, unity was huge, and it made for one hell of a celebration when it was all done. But it was pleasing to see, and probably why we've been able to retain so many players, to because everyone got a taste of that success and they want more of it. So, you know, you talk about years that you'll enjoy, that one was probably, you know, right up there as everyone was a part of it. It wasn't like we had a strong senior team and a poor performing reserves or Colts teams. Everyone was enjoying the success and probably building on top of each other.
Yeah, so speaking of the other grades, the Colts coach, Bo Woodman, came up to the league. Nothing seems to change on the field, though, in 2019. But how did Bo settle down in the role, and how did the players start to adapt and get used to his coaching style?
Yeah, look, Bo definitely put his own mark on how he coached. Every coach is going to be different, but the probably one thing you alluded to there that he didn't change the way, you know, we went about it in terms of our processes, our game plan. He kept it as normal as possible, and I think that was really important. I think if someone had to come in and try to change it, it may or may not have upset things. But I think Bo, you know, used what was probably put forward in the past in terms of the coaching standards and ideas, but then put his own sort of mould or flavour on the way he wanted to go about it. And he's done that again this year. So just tweaking things and not coming in and trying to change the wheel. And I think that was really important. One thing Bo does really well is work with the younger players, so trying to bridge that gap between coming into Colts and then making that league jump. He's really good at helping those players through that. So I think he added a lot of depth from some of the younger guys last year in giving those opportunities to some of the younger kids that probably created more depth and gave us some of the success we had last year.
Yeah, of course. Quickly with Bo Woodman, from what I saw, looked like he was really calm and relaxed on game day. Schofield, sometimes I thought, could get a bit angry and maybe angry at you guys for messing up. Bo Woodman, I thought, looks really relaxed and calm. What can you say on that?
Yeah, it looks just different, I suppose, coach styles. There's times that Jared would be very, very calm and measured. And they're probably the times that, you know, you wouldn't predict. You know, one thing about Skelly was really unpredictable, which probably was the reason he was such a great coach. When you get complacent, when he got angry and when he got, you know, annoyed at us. But when things were tough and you needed someone that was measured and calm and things, you know, were getting tested, that's when he was at his most level. So it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like he was predictable in his approach. And I think that's probably what had a lot to do with the success that's been built, is that he was so driven to succeed and he wouldn't settle for second best. Whereas, yeah, Bo, in a sense, he's got a completely different approach, in that it's more somewhat of a school teacher approach where he tries to work through it, and it's got its pros and its cons to that as well. But obviously with the group that we've got now, being at such a mature age, both, you know, across the group and some of the leaders there, it seems to have worked quite well that he has been quite measured and let us probably handle a lot of the, you know, being outspoken and aggressive, I suppose, talk on and off the field. It's coming more from the leadership group than it is potentially Bo, which also carries some weight and has some pros and cons to it. So I just think it's two styles that have complemented each other quite well, but certainly at times we've needed both.
All right. So so you had an outstanding season in 2019 for yourself. Did you do anything differently in the pre-season which maybe resulted in your form?
In me personally, is that what you're
saying? Yeah, in 2019.
I don't think it was a lot I did myself. I think it's just an element of luck with injury. You know, if you look at the years prior to that, I had okay years, had good years, some better than others, that I just couldn't get on the park for the full season. So having a full crack of injury-free football helped. I think going into the ruck permanently, I think after round 6 or 7 made a huge difference. Obviously, I'm sure the midfielders didn't appreciate that move because they don't get a lot of silver service in terms of hit-outs, but being around the footy that much certainly helps when you talk about these individual sort of accolades and stuff like that. But I was probably fortunate to get around the ball, but prior to that I needed, you know, the team needed a centre-half forward and needed me to play in that position, so I was happy to do so. But I think it was an element of a few different things that allowed me to probably have that sort of individual year that, you know, success that I had, that it may have not been there in previous years.
Yeah, so Zach Clark gets picked up by Essendon and you're the number one ruck, number one ruck role despite being 194 centimetres. Did you surprise yourself with how well you could perform, notching up 30-plus disposals week in, week out? And what's your ideal percentage in terms of spending time in the ruck and spending time up forward?
Yep, good question. If it was up to me, I wouldn't spend any time forward. But unfortunately, I have to go there. I don't know if you know any. That's why I said half forward, the hardest position on the ground. It is a tough gig, and if it's not your day, you can have some really dark days. That's why I give so much credit to forwards that perform. You know, Ben Sokol was such a great player because he consistently kicks goals and has the big games even when the chips are down. So I do like spending more time in the midfield. I'm probably not your traditional ruck. Like I said, I don't get a lot of hit-outs, but I like being around the footy and being able to run. So when Zach left, you know, we had a great battle playing with each other. The fact that we both wanted to spend a lot of time in the ruck. When you've got Zach Clark there, who's 201 centimetres, probably the best ruckman in the competition, it's pretty hard to demand time in the middle. So that was always a battle that I probably rarely won. So having that full exposure and getting almost as much time as I could handle in terms of my body not getting too sore or too tired, probably that full realm in the ruck, and I think that gave me the ability to run out games, you know, with those sort of, you know, disposals or what have you, being around the footy. You're not going to get that playing forward.
Yep, so heading on to Sand overnight, did you give yourself any chance, and do you feel guilty, somewhat guilty, pipping your teammate Kyle Horsley, who came runner-up three times after that night? And what was the massive week like with the grand final? Obviously, a lot of media and press that you would have had to done.
Yeah, the interesting week. And to put it straight, I had no inkling that I would be a chance. I was actually quite embarrassed. There was a bit of a build-up that I might be a possibility, and I just thought, I'm getting all this coverage and I'm going to finish out of the top 10 or out of the top 20, and I'm going to embarrass myself because I just didn't think, you know, I didn't think my year was as, you know, as good as someone making it out to be, and I didn't think that being a ruckman, you're going to attract that sort of attention, being somewhat of a midfielder's award. So I didn't go in and think I was any particular chance, and hence why, you know, I don't know if you've got a grand final, you can't have a drink on the night, so the night sometimes drag out a bit when you've got a grand final. So my enthusiasm to go probably wasn't at an all-time high, and I went with my housemate Lee Kitchen, and we probably rocked up a bit later than we probably should have. And then when I get there and I haven't polled a vote in the first sort of 10, 8 or 9 games, I thought, well, this is going down the path that I probably expected, where I'm not going to finish in the top 5. So it wasn't until midway through or towards the back end that I started to poll some votes. Obviously going back into the ruck, that probably helped with that, and being around the ball. And then got to the last 3 games and I was in firing range, but Kyle was a long way up front. Kane Mitchell was going to be hard to chase. But it wasn't until the last round where I was sitting next to Sox, and Sox kicked 5 or 6 in the last game, and I think I might have had 30-odd touches, and I thought, well, Sox has just cost me here because he's going to get 3 votes, and the horse had a pretty reasonable game as well, so I thought he will end up winning and I might get a close second. But I was fortunate or unfortunate to get 3 votes, and Horse was very unfortunate not to get 1. It would have been a great finish if he could have pulled a vote and we could have had that success together, and I think it's quite fitting. Kyle Horsley, he's definitely the best player I've ever played with, and he'll go down as arguably the greatest waffle player by the game, so it would have been very fitting for him to win it. And certainly, you know, there's a huge element of guilt and almost embarrassment beating him, but, you know, I was fortunate enough to take it on the night, and something I was really, really proud of now, and something I'll be proud of forever. So as much as I do feel for Kyle, I'm sure he'll come back better and better this year, and who knows, it might be his time to shine over an 8-game season.
And am I right in saying that Sandover was the first night with 3 votes instead of 5, 4, 3, 2, 1?
Yep, in a long time. I think there was a system in early years, you know, maybe during the 50s, 60s, where they had that system, but it had changed from a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 system to 3, 2, 1, which I think helped Subiaco as a team, because you'll find if you look back at previous winners, typically it doesn't go to the team that finishes or wins the most games. It normally went to often there was a correlation between that would finish lower on the ladder. So I think the 3-2-1 system helped better teams in the competition, because then, you know, typically if it's a 3-2-1 system, if you win by 50 or 60 points, you'll find that the 3 and 2 will go to the winning team, and typically a 1 might go to a losing team. With the 5-4-3-2-1 system, I think your lesser teams were picking up the 3 votes, and if you collect enough of them, you can go a long way to winning it. So I think that helped us a lot, both Kyle and I, having not lost a game, or we lost one game against South. And I think a lot of Subi boys bowled pretty well.
Yeah, no, that does seem better. I'm sure a lot of things were going through your head when you were up there chatting with Mark Reddings, but did you feel at that moment you could get drafted, as there was a bit of talk about you and forward Ben Sokol potentially getting picked up as mature age recruits, and is it still a goal for the future, even though you're 29, or are you happy with Subiaco?
Yeah, to answer your question, no, I wasn't expecting to get picked up. Look, it would have to take a very unique situation, and now that there's a talk of reducing the list, obviously that dream will never be fulfilled, I wouldn't have thought. But if it was going to take a really unique situation where someone needed a particular player, and to be fair, I'm not going to ruck in the AFL competition, so it would have to be a half-forward role and or a someone who required a bit of height in that sort of position. So I didn't think it would occur, but certainly would have grabbed it with both hands and was very well aware that it would take a lot of things to occur for that to happen, and a lot of things happen in my favour. So I wasn't overly hopeful of that. It certainly wouldn't have knocked it back if it had have occurred. And then moving forward, I'm very content and very happy to continue trying to build Subiaco and keep winning premierships. And if that's a level I get to, I'll look back on it fondly and have no regrets.
Yeah, keeping on the draft subject, do you think clubs need to take a bit of more punt on guys from WA? I know there's a lot of midfielders who have potentially been rookies on lists, but with like Marlon Pickett, a great story. Do you think clubs should be giving guys a second chance, or just a chance for that matter?
Yeah, I do think so. Like, we've talked about increasing the draft age, which I think would be a responsible way to go. I think looking at talent that's already proven, there's a lot of players that get picked up at, you look at West Coast and Fremantle sides that come into the Waffle and they don't get a touch. They can't kick a goal, and they probably wouldn't get a game in the Subi team, and yet you get a Ben Sokol that kicks 5, 6, 7 goals every week in big games, in grand finals, in state games, that doesn't get a look in. I find that hard to fathom, and I can understand there's an argument to that, but, if anyone's kicking bags of 5 or 6 in the Waffles and they're on an AFL list, they're going to get an opportunity, so why wouldn't you give them an opportunity on a list? But you've got to look at the success. Sammy Menegola is a great story. Liam Ryan's a fantastic story. Tim Kelly's probably the textbook example. So there's a lot of great examples, and why wouldn't you take a punt? You put them on your rookie list for a year, give them an opportunity, give them some exposure, and you're going to see very early on in practice games when they're still kicking bags of goals or still getting lots of the ball or playing their team role that they're worth taking a punt on. So I think Ryan Borchett's one in our side that should definitely get some exposure in that area when he's kicking goals at such a young age. But there's an appetite, I suppose, for AFL clubs to take younger players and try to get them early and craft them or mould them. But I think it's been proven that players that are performing already may be in the long term a safer bet, especially as teams may reduce their list to 35 or 40 players.
I definitely agree with you, and also like the state games, players have been dominating in that, like Jai Bolton and those guys. So yeah, it definitely should be looked at in more depth.
Yeah. We spoke to Harry Marsh and Gus Litherland last year, and they spoke about the professionalism and the inclusive, welcoming environment at Subiaco. What do you put the success down to, having only lost one game in the past 2 years?
Yeah, well, that culture is probably the reason I went there in the first place, right? So Gus and Marsh, testify the fact that a culture has been built over generations, a decade, probably the decade before us as well. So that culture, it's a very loose term. I don't really like to use it because people get carried away with culture, but I think if you come down and you get a part of that club, Ben Newton will say the same, you'll see why that success occurs, and it's driven by those sort of, I suppose, hidden standards that we hold each other accountable to, and I think that's the driving force and has a huge part to do with the success. So as much as I don't like to talk about that culture, it's probably the word to describe why we've been so successful and why we've had such a good 6-7 years of football. It's sort of that ingrained belief and ingrained culture that we aspire to hold and will continue to try to improve. That's probably you can attribute some of our success to.
Yeah, now the social media team at the Lions have been putting some stuff up on their pages called the Subi Sizzle, where they're asking a heap of different players some questions. A lot of the players have said that you're stealing towels and other blokes' belongings. Have you been stitched up here, or is this true?
No, that's an absolute true in all its forms. So I'm one very renowned for stealing towels and have been caught on numerous occasions. I think they are getting carried away with other belongings. I certainly have never gone down that path, but I'm one to certainly shower after every training session, where some of the gentlemen, it surprised me, they still don't. But I'm notorious from going straight from work and not bringing a towel. So, you know, if it's in the change room and it's hanging up, I think it's fair game. And I've stuck by that through the 6 years I've been there. But no, I certainly have got my justice urge from the Subi Sizzle. I deserved every bit of that.
Nah, fair enough. And secondly, the thoughts on the popular budgie smugglers.
Yeah, look, it's that was one of Subiaco's, you know, Gus Littleton's ideas and productions. I think it was taken up quite well, and we've got some boys down there that certainly like to flaunt them. I don't probably have the rig anymore to be flaunting such attire, but a couple of boys really enjoy getting their rigs out, and it's probably the best way to do it. So it was a good idea by Gus.
Now, something that a lot of people may not know, but your cousins with Richmond superstar and former Gold Coast captain Tom Lynch. How much do you keep in contact with him or see him, and how much how much advice do you give each other? How much advice do you give each other?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I probably speak to him, if not every day, every second day, at least a few times a week. We're very close, probably closer as mates than we are as family in terms of cousins. He's one of my best mates, and yeah, from a young age, we're only 2 years apart, so you can imagine how competitive we both were in the backyard, even if footy or cricket, and I think obviously he's ended up getting a nod on me in the footy sense, but I think I can knock him around the backyard in cricket still, so I'll retain that ledger. But in terms of advice, like, we don't talk a lot about footy, it's more about life. When we do help each other out, I'll certainly bounce things off what we're doing, get his opinion on it, and how they sort of try to, you know, if we've got any issues or we're trying different things, we definitely bounce ideas off each other. And he's now got such great experience around. He's been a captain of a club, and we talk about how he was facing there, and now he's gone to such a successful club in Richmond, and how the two cultures are so different and how they go about things are so different. So it's been a great journey to follow and get a real insight on how clubs and organisations run things, but how he's gone about his journey. I don't know if you know much about him, but there's no one that I've met that is as modest or as easy going as Tom is, so he deserves every success that comes his way, and it's been a pleasure to be a part of it in terms of, you know, watching him grow up.
Did you go over for the grand final last year when they beat the Giants, and did you even see Liam Baker, your old Subi?
Yeah, yep. Little Bakes. Yeah, no, definitely. I was there for the whole thing. I was even nearly wrote that Monday, so I was, got over. I was never going to miss that. I was there for his first game when he pulled that jumper on for Richmond against Carlton, and then I went over there again for one of the finals and then for the grand final, so. Very boring game, probably much like the Subi South game, but the game itself was terrible, but the celebrations after it were very enjoyable. I was there for the Saturday, there for the Sunday, and I had to come back from work on the Monday, and to be fair, my liver was probably about to fail, so it was a good time to leave. And little Bakes was up and about, as he always is, so it was great to have a few beers with him, and obviously Marlon, I played some state footy with him, so have a few beers after the game with him as well. It was what a journey for him, and what a story that was in itself, so... it was great, and seeing Tom come from, you know, a club that didn't win too many games, they have a lot of success. All we ever wanted to do was play in an AFL premiership, and he did it his first year, so that was huge.
Indeed, would have been pretty special. So finally, moving to the present before we let you go, you must be really looking forward to the August 1 start date. How much you've been training, do you agree with the 50% pay cut? And having said that, how do you balance full-time work with footy and other things you like to do outside of the game?
Yeah, so the first part of that, August 1, look, in a perfect world, we would have all loved to get back sooner rather than later, but obviously there's bigger factors at play that couldn't happen. So that's the date it is. It gives us 2 months to really hone in, and I can't wait. You know, it's only got an 8-game season, so every game's a final, so we need to make the most of every game, so... forward to that challenge. The pay cut, the 50% pay cut, $6,000 salary cut per game, I think it is. Look, it is what it is. It's a part of this new fixture that's been put together, and, you know, I'm not a against that at all. You know, I would have, I'll play for free if I have to. I just want to play footy and play for Subiaco. So it's that doesn't really concern me individually. It's more those, you know, just want to make sure the people that put the time in around the club, be that physios, trainers, you know, they put a lot of time and a lot of effort into, and you just hope, you know, they continue to get looked after financially, because there's a lot of, you know, a lot of work that goes in behind the scenes. And what was your last question?
Oh, just on, like, work, what are you doing at the moment?
Oh, how do we balance?
Other things you like to do outside of the game?
Yeah, so I'm in the property space, so I head up an acquisitions business here, so for performance property, we buy a lot of property around Perth, and nationally we buy a lot of property, so for that's probably the hardest challenge I have, to be honest. If I try to balance work and footy commitments, I find that to be the most difficult. You leave the house at 6 o'clock in the morning, you don't get home till 9 o'clock at night, have something to eat, go to bed and do it again. That routine can take it out of you, and then a lot of my work, I'm required to work Saturdays, you know, to get the properties or whatever, so not having my phone on me from pretty well 12 till 6 o'clock causes issues, and like on training nights, that's probably the hardest thing. I'm sure every waffle footballer will attest to that. I really feel sorry for the guys that are on the tools all day. You know, Kyle Horsley, he's an electrician, he works sometimes from 6 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, finishes at 12 o'clock, gets straight to the game after working 6 hours on the tools, and plays out, and is best on ground most weeks. So, you know, I don't know how those guys do it. I'm in an office chair at a desk most days, so it's not as fatiguing physically. Sometimes it can be mentally and emotionally challenging, but certainly not physically. So I do feel sorry for those guys.
Yeah, it would be difficult.
Yep. We'll let you go, Della. It's been real good of you to take our call today. We wish you the best for the rest, or for the 2020 season and beyond. Hopefully we'll see you out there lighting up the field in a few months' time.
Beautiful. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Thank you.
Enjoy your podcast. Take care.
Yeah, so following on with that interview with Della, we've pretty much covered it all, but just in, Fremantle Dockers forward Cam McCarthy has been in hospital after a training collapse. Pretty shocking, I guess. Peter Bell said Cam was training really well with a small group of teammates in a non-contact session this morning when he suddenly collapsed on the ground. He was immediately assessed by our medical staff and an ambulance was called. So, you know, obviously we wish him well. Cam, if you guys want to touch on?
Yeah, not good for Darty. Hopefully there's more information to come because, to have the Darty's player in the compound is not good at all.
Of course. I think it's 10 days from Fremantle's first game.
It's Brisbane.
Hopefully he'll be all good for that. 8 days till the first game, Richmond and Collingwood at the G on the Thursday night. So hopefully he'll be able to get it out there. Anything else, boys, want to quickly add on before we wrap it all up?
No, I think we're good.
I've got to say, what I have to say, we've got a huge show next week. Massive. Yeah. For the first time in our history, to celebrate footy being back, we have two guests in one, which includes our second one to be in person to help with the tips in Strife, good call, bad call. And we might even chuck a quiz in there. And of course, the only way you know who these two people are is to follow our Instagram and like our Facebook at Centre Square Podcast. And while you're at it, subscribe to the YouTube.
Of course. You've pretty much done it there, Ethan. But until then, it's been a pleasure having you guys along the ride with us through this show. But until then, you've been listening to Sport FM 91.3, your football headquarters. Take care. Bye for now.